This week's episode is brought to you by City Center Gallery and Books, located at 112 Hay Street in historic downtown Fayetteville. To learn more about downtown Fayetteville's only bookstore, go to citycentergallery.com.
For I'm longing for dear old Broadway, longing for dear old town. Yes, I'm longing to stroll on Broadway, watching the world go round. To be back where the boys all know me, back where the girls all bow.
This is the North Carolina Theater Story Show. I'm your host, Lynn Pryor. James Johnson is our technical director. We're coming to you from a 100-year-old house, former home of the Gilbert Theater, here at historic Haymont in Fayetteville, North Carolina. This is show number 17. You're listening to us, of course, at nctheaterstories.com. Our guests tonight are two fellows very dear to all of our hearts, James Dean and John Dorner, who were here last week but got a call from me shortly afterward saying, "I need you back. The person I had scheduled can't come until the following week." And that is the director. That person is the director of Young Frankenstein the musical. He'll be here next week. But right now, I'm so glad to have you guys here for any reason at all.
It's good to be here, Lynn.
Thank you.
Well, super duper.
Thank you, Lee.
Now, this may be a bit redundant, but I'm going to do it anyway, having listened to our show just a few hours ago from last week. But here it is, opening remarks. Everyone at this table today has years of experience as a storyteller. Who are the people who experience our stories? A teenager? A 60-year-old man who is seeing a play for the first time? A veteran theater-goer, a newspaper theater critic. They are all here under one roof. What is their experience going to be? Do they all critique the play? The answer is yes. Everyone entering the theater is a critic. The question is, how does an audience talk back to the performers? We know how the newspaper critic does. But how does everybody else? And that's our first little topic for tonight, guys, is just how do people talk back to... In an earlier conversation with one of you, I said, I think a consistent cough from the audience is talking back.
That can be telling, yes.
Very telling. How else?
Well, you know, the obvious answer is, I know when you do comedies, when you're involved in a comedy, you gauge the laughs every night, and there are some lines that are intended to be major laughs, some lines intended to be small laughs, some lines that are some punchlines intended one way or another. And the casts that I'm familiar with are always, you know, last night that one was much bigger, or I got a bigger laugh this night than I did last night. So I think that's one of the obvious ways.
Yeah, I think
that's a very specific.
Right. You're right. Reaction. That's the feedback, and the nature of the crowd. Might be that they're enjoying it tremendously, but they just...
Yeah, and as an actor, you get a sense of how well the audience is, or how attentive the audience is, I think.
Yeah, right. So, James...
I think you know that on certain days, it's quieter laughter, and on other days, it's bigger laughter.
True, but some of the...
They're not criticizing, they're just less vocal than the others.
But if you've lost them, I mean, there are things that I've noticed. For years, I've sat in the back of theaters and watched as people are doing this or that, perhaps looking at their program. They are shifting in their seats.
Well, if you could only read their minds.
Well, but no.
Here's another 2 hours I won't get back, somebody's thinking to themselves.
No, but I mean, I think you can with... Now, something else I've noticed, that when someone goes up in a line... That is when you have absolute dead silence in the auditorium. And we had that recently, and something was going on between the we had a at the Gilbert.
I was there.
We really shouldn't be specific, though.
No, well, that's poor. That poor,
not mention any names.
Right. No, I shan't. But that poor girl. But you could have heard.
Or boy.
A truss shot. A truss drop.
And that was a kid with that young lady should not have been left out.
Left hanging. Hanging. It was not good.
The director was in the house, and the director had addressed the audience before. So I don't think it would have been untoward for him to step in and take that lady over, and he didn't.
It was about 2 minutes too slow. And Mary, do you have something to add to that?
Oh, well, speaking as a person, I should say we are doing a bit of running around, too. I mean, we try to keep up with...
Mary was so much involved, of course, with the... I didn't mean to get into that.
Of course, we're merely saying that when you have young, inexperienced actors doing monologues, that someone should be on book for them. Right. That's all.
And I guess our listeners may not know that the camp is just that. It's an opportunity for young people.
Right.
Exactly. So there's more information that's worth sharing. All right. Anything else? How Alex would talk back to us? Well, you can always walk out.
That's talking
back in the big way. I remember when we were doing Lysistrata, and there was a mother and husband and wife and two teenage daughters came to see Lysistrata, and evidently they had not read it. And I knew them casually, and I was very pleased to see them there for the first time. And When the character, I forget the name, came out with under a tunic and a huge and erected penis onto the theater, she jumped up, the mother jumped up, and gave a signal to her family, and they stormed out of there, and I thought, it was an oh shit moment, I'll tell you. It was streaming down. Of course, the play was going on, and streaming down the aisle. And I said, oh gosh, right. Intercept them and say, follow them down, apologize. I did none of that.
So you did the right thing. I think the best thing would have been just let it go.
Let it go. And thank you.
There's a warning on the poster, right?
Well, and anyway, people's sensibilities are. Audiences will tell you in very dramatic ways like that, or simple ways
in subtle ways. That you, the actor on stage, can read, sometimes someone sitting in the audience who's there for that purpose.
Yes. So we're talking this week, last week, believe it or not, about theater criticism, and. Everybody's a critic. I mean, they leave the theater, and what do they say? Perhaps to their friend. And they said, I love that. You know, gosh, wasn't that good? I'm going to tell my friends about it. Oh, that's a critique.
Mm-hmm.
Or something less than that.
If I have the opportunity, I'd like to stand in the lobby during the intermission and eavesdrop.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, but most of the time, James, you're continually on stage. It's marvelous. But don't you know from on the stage about a lot of this stuff?
I'm not sure that you really do, because you have to be concentrating on what you're doing on stage.
Uh-huh.
And even if, as I said, some audiences are quieter than others and they don't laugh as much, or they're not as vocal, and you may notice that in the back of your head, but you still got to try to concentrate on what you're doing.
Surely.
And keep moving forward.
Sure,
with that.
Of course. That's absolutely right. Well, I think that's we know that criticism happens in all kinds of ways. Now we're going to come. I promised you two that we would not have a quiz, but we're going to. But it's a very benign one. Well, a fun one, I like to think. It's a true and false.
Let's bring it on.
And what I'm going to ask a question, and then you just spontaneously say true, false, agree or not.
Is Aristotle going to be on this?
Two of them. There are two of his questions.
Oh.
Yes, in fact, as a matter of fact, yes. I know what a fan you are of the Poetics. You leave us all in the dust on that topic.
It makes me sick.
Well, it can. And then there it is.
Nobody else knows about it, so you can say anything people will
believe. Now, true or false? First one. And James, we're not going to keep score because there isn't a prize. Because this is quite subjective, but it's going to be a lot of fun. True or false? The director should leave democracy behind.
True.
Yes, I would say true as well.
Absolutely. Without any much cogitation, you're both saying true.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want input from actors.
No, that's not what you said.
Well, democracy, let's define democracy. Democracy is when you have a lot of input from
well, you can have input, but you don't necessarily. The final decision is the director's. The tyrant director.
James, I didn't ask for your opinion. Even though it was a value. Now,
he's been on the other
but,
end.
But you're saying absolutely.
I'm saying the director is the one who makes the creative choices. It is the director's vision that the production is trying to realize. And as such, it is the director who makes decisions towards that. The way I make decisions, or the way a director makes decisions, might be to gather everybody's opinion, or might be to write everything down.
But that's
what I mean.
If it's like a democracy, you might have other actors directing other actors, and you don't want that going on.
No, the first rule, or second or third rule of act of directing, of putting on a play, you don't direct another actor. How true.
Right.
But you do welcome input from your team.
Absolutely. That's what an ensemble is about.
Right.
Everybody's contributing.
So
there is one.
You're right. But there's like the president of the country, final choices, decisions, and all. But you're not absolute when I say, should he leave democracy behind? You're saying that you welcome input.
Yes.
Enough said about that. Okay. True or false? The director must know the play better than the playwright, or frequently knows the play better than the playwright.
I'm either way about that. I would fall somewhere in the middle. I think sometimes that might be true, and sometimes no. Sometimes true, sometimes false.
James?
I think the person who knows the most about the play is the person who wrote it.
But how many...
is coming from a playwright.
Well, coming from a playwright, but coming from someone who's never... can't put two words together. I'm speaking for myself. When we've had numerous original plays in our theater, and I've had them say to me... In fact, last week, didn't I quote that letter from... Oh, no, it was John Merritt, or was it Chris Canfield? One of those two playwrights, early in the early days of the Gilbert... said that we brought things out and that he had never thought of like that. Anyway, so
I say this one quote by Wilson Meisner, which I think relates sort of to this, even though it's about a critic rather than a director. He said, "A drama critic is a person who surprises the playwright by informing him what he meant." And that falls right in line here. Because the director may think he knows more than the playwright, but the playwright actually knows more.
All right.
I got to say, though, I've been in circumstances where we're working on material and we're working with the playwright present and the director. And I still say I could go either way with this, because sometimes the director had a better handle on the material and was a better guiding force, and sometimes the playwright was the better guiding force.
But at the same time, the playwright has written the words and the drama involved in it, but the director is putting that up on stage, which is a whole different set of shoes
So
they're wearing different hats all along, but the director and another director could interpret it completely differently and get a good production at the same time.
I always tell my playwrights that the play is your baby, and the production in question might not be the definitive production.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, mm-hmm. it's still your baby.
I like to say that a play is a skeleton, and then by bringing it onto the stage, we're adding the meat and the clothes and everything else to it to make it a full, complete thing.
Nobody wants them to hear what I have to say.
Well, I do want to hear it.
But I don't have anything to say.
Oh, see, now he's getting peevish.
Call his mother.
Getting peevish. I'm going to, you know, this is getting, I'm going to have to call your mother. Well, again, I've had playwrights say to me that I had never thought it looked at it this way and that sort of thing. All right, true or false? Critics are as important as the actors.
I would say false as well.
You say false?
Yeah, I'm saying false, yes.
False. Now, if we look at the creme de la creme of theater critics around the world, Kenneth Tynan in England, you were mentioning Eric Bentley in America. When you get that kind of in-depth criticism, where they know they know all the playwright's works, they know the themes that he revisits. You know, look at the engine, water engine. That theme recurs in so many of his plays, doesn't it? About awful people. But you don't have any qualifications. You're saying that critics are not as important as the actors.
No, because critics are after the fact. The actors, along with the director and everybody else involved in the production, are creating the piece.
But
the critics are criticizing it after.
But is this completing? I'm being the devil's advocate. Is this completing the conversation that they might bring up? I mean, you tell a story on stage, and the story is out there, and this person walking out of the theater is saying this about it, that person is saying something else about it. Everyone has their own prism that they're seeing it through, and then sometimes a really good critic can bring it all together.
Well, I'm not saying that you ignore what people say. You can make your play better, possibly, by listening to some of what people have to say. But it's still after the fact, and it doesn't make the critic more important than the actors involved in the piece.
Well, these absolutes are just.
Well, I think actors make better theater than critics.
I'm taking this question from somewhere. I read it someplace. Somebody, it was a critic, and he said, "Well, I'm as important as the actors." I realize it, but trying to see, you know, walking in his shoes, anyway, it's something to think about, isn't it? True or false, the director is an ideal audience of one.
These are not really true and false questions, well, are they?
But give me a break and treat them as such.
Yeah.
I would say I'm leaning toward false.
As would I.
Well, I'm sorry I shocked, told you to be quiet. You have something to say. We appreciate it.
True or false,
the director is an ideal audience of one.
It depends on the director, doesn't it?
Well, if the director is sitting there night after night, look, right now Steve is down there looking at the rehearsal for Young Frankenstein. He is looking, he is the audience. He's sitting here, he's sitting there, he's making a suggestion there.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm sitting there watching my play that I directed. I am anything but the ideal audience. Critical, finicky, fussy.
Well,
you know, I'm not someone who's going to sit there and enjoy my play and love it. That to me is the ideal audience.
No. I think what this is driving at is that the director is somebody who's seeing all the things that need nipping and tucking. So he's an audience. So this is kind of a strange combination of words here, but I think the director, after all, is somebody who is criticizing constantly, hopefully in a way that is not
It is sort of dependent on the director. I've had directors who, during rehearsals and throughout performances, will be playing with their cell phone, and then they'll just pop up and occasionally notice something. But uh-huh. There directors are more hands off. There are more some directors who are more hands on, and yes.
I see where this is coming from. This question. Anyway, moving right along. True or false, if a play seems dull or static, it is the actor's fault. True or false?
False.
Whose fault is it?
It's a collective.
Yeah.
It might be a really good actor in a really bad play. It might be a really good play that's been directed badly. So I think I would have to see and assess. With
sound
a critic's eye.
But isn't it? Well, I think it's a lot of blame to go around. But isn't it partly blame the director?
Absolutely.
Sure.
It
depends on the actual situation, though. Because
If I'm directing a play and I tell my actors all the good stuff is you, I take responsibility for everything that's wrong. So on that level, I see a dull play. I'm thinking, yeah, the director could have done a better job, or the director didn't have what he needed, or whatever.
Sometimes,
but there might be other reasons too.
Yeah,
and the director did cast the actor.
Theoretically, yeah, but that's not always true either.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, no, but the director is the one that should be very aware of the tempo, and all of those things,
mm-hmm.
and the actor is up there and doesn't see the big picture. This is why I think the director is the perfect audience of one, because he's able to. First of all, he has done hours and hours and hours of prep before actors do anything. And he has this idea about...
You're not going to let this go without
it. I feel like this quiz does have right and wrong answers in your mind.
Alright, stand corrected. True or false, the director's concept, internal, is more important than the external. True or false?
The director's
concept... about a character, the lead, internal acting, like 20th century acting, is more important than the external, which is, the 19th century, all that declamation and stuff. But that's not the best example. But do you know what I mean by if an actor
one is more important than the other? So
these questions sound like riddles.
Yeah, it's hard to say true or false when you're dealing with one or the other.
But that's what you say then. Yeah. That's fine to say that. And that's good. Okay, true or false. Blocking a show is the director's job, never an actor's. True or false?
False.
Why do you say that, James?
Because when I'm directing, I like to have the actors try to find their blocking in the first place. I may have an idea of where I want them to be or what I want to happen within the set piece, but I want to give them a chance to explore on the stage and find their own way. And many times they can find their own way better than me just saying, go here, go there, go this.
Yeah, if you have actors who are comfortable on stage and comfortable in their own bodies, then they should have some idea of where they're going to go.
Well, they know their character, they know the motivation, they know the ins and outs of the scene. But think back to early days, my early days as an actor. Boy, the directors had every last foot down on paper. Now you move over here, and
And I don't like that. As an actor, I don't like that at all. I don't want to be told every single thing that I might do. It might say in the play that that character laughs. Well, maybe he does, or maybe he doesn't. Let the actor find that.
Yes. No, I think one of the key things to do is black out all those italics words.
I black out everything.
Except the one that will choreograph every step. You know, and that's my least, as an actor, that's my least favorite
way of doing.
Some directors are very hands on, and some are very hands off. So.
And I pretty much just don't work that way.
Yeah. True or false? This is my favorite question among them all. Thinking on stage is not something actors should do.
That's wrong.
Actors should not think on stage. Right. False.
You must think on stage.
Do you mean playing thinking?
Not playing thinking, but well, yes, in a way, playing thinking. Well, you'll hear actors sometimes say. The director's moving them along or something. He said, well, I'm thinking about it. Then I'm going to speak. You two are in agreement on that. There are people, if we had a third or fourth person here, I know people who say, and I think Uta Hagen is one, that in terms of, and you can all stand corrected, but somebody, you know, you don't think on stage. You just, like right
no,
now.
No, no, no. Well, see, that's different because I'm talking about thinking.
Literal thinking.
You might be thinking his line is going on and you're thinking and then your line comes out. You're not thinking before your line, otherwise you have all these big pauses there.
No, you're listening, goodness knows.
You're listening and you're thinking.
And responding. But I don't think that's what this... But anyway, this is one of those things that bears people digging into. But you have your opinions and I certainly appreciate them. But certainly we want to be listening and reacting. True and false, good actors... Okay, here. Good actors listen to each other and then build on the other's speeches. True or false?
True.
I guess that's the
best. I tell my actors half your job is listening.
Is listening, yeah.
Plus, if you listen, you can hear your cues.
Yeah,
that always helps.
It helps.
James, you didn't have to keep score. I'm glad because you've had so much trouble with the scorekeeping.
I won,
but you won. Well, anyway, and there were no prizes. But there I have. We mentioned Aristotle. I have two quotes from Aristotle, just for you, John. Here's one. Those who feel, and this is, you know, this is the method, he was an early method person, wasn't he? Those who feel emotion are most convincing through natural sympathy with the character they represent. So that's, 2,000 years ago?
Aristotle had a lot to say about sympathy. He thought that was an extremely potent emotion. Mm-hmm.
Here's another quote from Aristotle. Actors are the most imitative of living creatures. I guess none of us agree with that. Disagree with that.
That's true.
All right, what's next? The quiz.
It's like he looked up the actor in a dictionary.
now, James, speaking of quotes, I've been wanting, for the last several months, I've been wanting to share this Shavian quote, which I absolutely love. It's about living a good life in general, but has a lot to say to the theater world. I've been waiting for someone with your voice to read it.
Does everyone in your audience, your audience here, know what you mean by Shavian?
George Bernard Shaw. But then in his later years, he dropped George and just became Bernard Shaw. He lived to be in his mid-90s. He started out extremely poor and became... and his book on criticism... paper or what you call it on criticism. I've never read it, but I've been told it is the definitive paper essay on theater criticism.
Well, then we could have just brought that and read it.
Read that instead of all this other stuff.
Book on tape.
Okay, so this is from George Bernard Shaw. This is the true joy in life. Being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one. Being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. I am of the opinion that my life belongs to the whole community, and as long as I live, it is my privilege to do for it what I can. I want to be thoroughly used up when I die, for the harder I work, the more I live. I rejoice in life for its own sake. Life is no brief candle to me. It is a sort of splendid torch which I have got hold of for the moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations.
Oh, James, thank you. Ooh, wow. Well, as somebody who is now an official octogenarian, my little candle at times flickers and flames up, and it hasn't gone out yet.
Oh, you've always been flaming.
Flaming.
I was afraid he was talking about me when he said octogenarian.
Well, no, all right, James, that does it.
Uh-oh.
Now, here's our next section of our evening together. I've asked you to think about the most memorable stage show, play, or musical that you have ever seen. Or one of them. And you said immediately to me when we talked about this before we started taping, you said
Equus.
And Equus. Why did you say that?
I had an experience watching that, unlike any. I was in college at the time, and Equus was running on Broadway. I believe Anthony Hopkins originated the role in London, and by the time my story takes place, Anthony Perkins was in the lead, and I went to see it because I was at the time a young acting student in community college. And sometime after that, Richard Burton did a limited run of Equus on Broadway, and a friend of mine acquired student tickets. Student tickets for this production was on stage. They had a bleacher, a semicircular bleacher, of audience facing the audience, and the play took place in the middle. And there I was, a young college student, acting student, sitting about 10 feet from Richard Burton doing the monologues in that play. It was one of the most moving theater experiences I've ever had.
Well, fabulous. Oh, don't you love it when, you know, I've had, you know, one or two of those. The unforgettable. James Dean.
Well, I'd have to say when I was in Los Angeles, I saw a version of Sam Shepard's True West. And I cannot remember the second person who played. There were two brothers in that play, and the one I knew was Ed Harris. And it was a terrific version of the play, really, really terrific. Although we went out and got trashed afterwards, and of course we all felt that Ed was actually miscast as the tamer of the two brothers, rather than the wild one. He should have been the wild one, as he's proved in his movie roles. So that was it for me.
I see. Thank you very much. I said during, before we started taping, one of mine would be something we did downstairs on that tiny stage, In the Blood, Susan Laurie Parks. Mm-hmm. You were in it.
Yeah.
And James was in it. No, James was not in it. He's giving me a signal to move right along, and I'll see if we're going to heed that or not. But now let's start talking about directing.
Now, wait a minute, Lynn. I thought we were going to talk about criticism. What does directing have to do with criticism?
I'm glad you brought that up, John, because others have been wondering about that. What do these topics have to do with criticism? Well, a good critic is someone who knows these things. First of all, companies should do their very best to present the best possible product you can on stage for all these people who are going to watch it, including critics. So they've done all this prep. Don't you want to have a critic who is going to look at something and say, oh my gosh, what excellent directing. Look how he handled this or not, or didn't handle this. Look about how he worked to use the crowd scenes here. So the critic is, that's why I think this one question I had for you about true and false, as a critic is important, is, and I'm not trying to drag that back into the conversation, except because I am, but that is that when they're that quality, then they can be coming in, and the criticism, if you read Chinin's criticisms, there have to be times when directors or actors will read his criticism and be thankful or ready to shoot him, one of the two. That's why I think what we're doing is really the foundation for good criticism. That good critics should know all of these things and bring this knowledge to the printed word.
When I've written reviews, I've found that directing is the most has been the most difficult thing to sort of pin down, because it's difficult to always know where the director's hand has been, and where this, like, well, this was a really great, you know, lighting cue, but perhaps that was somebody else's idea, perhaps that was a little, you know,
It's like the President of the United States, you know, it's the Obama administration, well, you know, he's blamed or praised for everything, and there's all kinds of people under him who are, you know, doing things. So the director is up here, and he's the one that is, you know, having to say, well, the director should have done this, should have done that, well, who knows. But the truth is the ultimate boss and all that. But I'm thinking about the times when I have looked at plays, and one fairly recently where I said, oh, God, the way this scene was blocked, I wouldn't have done it. And of course, you know, those of us, and little humble me, I mean, people outshine me every day of the week, but you see things, and when you're in the business, and you... Make decisions. You say, I would have made a different choice.
Absolutely.
And so I think when you are a critic with this kind of background, that I like to think we're shedding some important lights on what a critic should, how this critic should be prepared. All right. So there. Is that enough of answering that question?
Convinced me.
Okay.
You didn't convince me. The horse is dead, Lynn. Let's keep moving.
Curmudgeon comes to mind. Now, four things throw at you two directors, and if you would just very briefly give how you as a director handle this in your prep and in the process of putting up a show. Now, may I just, before I forget saying it again, I'm going to say it right now, and this may look like yet another tangent. One of the first things I ever say to a director, 21 years ago or in the old days, was, anybody, actors, I would speak to them and I'd say, the product is as important, no, the process is as important as the product. We have all been in shows where it has just been hell with the way the directing is doing it, whatever, people that have been around 100,000 years and are treating newcomers shabbily and so on. And so when I started this theater, I said, I said this is going to be our mantra. This is our goal is to all the process, meaning everything that goes on from the auditions through closing night. It's as important as the opening night. Now, there are four things I want you both to talk a little bit about. Okay, interpretation. When you have been assigned to play, you might get a play at Fayetteville Tech next summer, but you don't know what it would be, right?
Correct.
But when you're handed it, what's the first thing you want to do?
Well, the first thing I want to do is have a point of view about it. Something that about the play that grabs you and strikes you as unique or interesting or worthwhile, mm-hmm. and from there you build. So you get the play and you have to have an idea about how to do it, and from that idea your interpretation will evolve.
That's when you choose the spine at that point. The whole
that's thing. Part of it. Yeah, that yeah. comes into it.
Yeah,
you know. Every time you do a play, you know, you never have enough time, you never have enough budget, you never have enough. So, my experience, you know, I deal with modest productions, so there are things I can't expect, there are things I can't do. I can't have, you know, a million light instruments, I can't have, you know, $100,000 of scenery. So something from the play, something from the text has to be conveyable, if that's a good word, from stage to audience.
All right.
And I have to do that without the budget.
Surely.
Without the finery.
James, you have
to... I agree with everything that John has said, but you have to really, it has to be something that you have a connection with, otherwise I say...
You as a person, yeah, as an individual.
Yeah, yeah. If I don't have a connection with it, I don't want to do it.
Well, then you would refuse something if you're...
I would.
And I think we've all been, I speak for myself, but I think you guys have worked in plays that you didn't particularly care for, but it was a career move, or it was whatever the reason, you know, you went to a play that you didn't choose, that you don't like.
Yes.
And you don't do your best work, and the process doesn't come off the way it should.
Yeah.
And there's no point in doing it if you're going to be unhappy through the whole experience.
How true. All right, thank you both. Okay, visual elements. The variety of staging and pictures and unity and stuff. How do you... Is that hard to talk about?
Well, give me spectacle. If I can get it. That's what I'm looking for. You know, that's something that is going to keep the audience's visual interest. Orally as well as visually.
We've got to do a number. In the second half of this evening's program, when we do the oral history, I'm going to be talking about at least one of our monologue shows. And and here are these monologues, and one of them is Ann Costo. And anyway, she was alone on stage, and she had a lot of lanterns, and she was talking about these lanterns and talking about light and how she loves the light from each one of these different lanterns. And other than that, she was alone on stage with a spot. She was just spotted like this and talking about those lanterns. I mean, it's as good a theater as you'll get anywhere. So anything to add on visual elements?
No, it varies from play to play because it depends on, like I was talking last time about this play that I wrote about that has a sideshow carnival aspect to it. And so visually it's going to have to be very colorful and everything has to move in and out of spaces. Mm-hmm. And all of that has to be designed in some way and hopefully you surround yourself with the right lighting people and the right people who know how to do the kind of set that you have in your mind.
And so here's a time when you wouldn't say to the actors, just start moving. You wouldn't necessarily say that then, right?
Well, no, not at that point. You might when they get up on their feet, Lynn.
No, I mean...
Start moving.
No, I mean, maybe so.
You have to have the space first,
yeah,
yes.
Right.
Something like that would be difficult to have them find their own blocking early because... you wouldn't know what the space was actually going to be.
Sure.
James is a very visual... He's literally a visual artist. He's a painter. And I remember one thing that stuck out years ago when he had directed Wojciech was that it was visually very sort of memorable.
Sure, it was.
Very,
yes, it was.
A lot of use of color and makeup. And the set was constructed and... nothing was normal.
But just who can...
We tried to do the same thing with the Blue Room because when we did that, we had a big screen that had images projected on it for each different scene. It was, but it was very colorful.
Yeah. Well, Blue Room, superb evening. Wojciech was one of the few times I think I've cried. I broke into tears two or three times at the curtain speech over all these years. And one of them was with Wojciech. That character was one of the most tragic things that's soldier.
Yeah.
And I'm just, you know, it's the second or third night or something, and I'm, you know, standing in front of the audience and going to introduce, do my usual spiel with sponsors and so on, and say something about the play, and I choked up. And so this is what theater can do to you, and just the memory. And I still get choked up talking, thinking about all these years later with In the Blood. And we can talk more about why that was so superb another time. Okay, aesthetics, flow, rhythm, tempo.
I think it's part and parcel of what we're talking about, the whole package. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I like to not have to worry about time. You know, some plays run long, some plays, you know, don't. And I think that, for me, if I'm not worried about the time, then the tempo is right. You know, if I'm not sitting there thinking this is going on too long.
The ideal audience of one. As the director, well, okay, I'm not beating this to death. I'm right.
It depends on your definition of ideal.
I don't think the ideal audience of one is somebody who sees the play over and over and over again, though.
I'm talking about rehearsal.
Yes.
Well, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
No, and what John just said is what I'm talking about. You're the ideal audience. You are coming up. You're seeing these things that the actors can't see. This not that third eye.
No, but I think a director is more critical than the average audience.
Well, but you're critical at an extremely important juncture.
Hopefully, in a positive.
Well, in a juncture.
Hopefully, in positive influence.
And hopefully, there's tempo within the tempo, and so you know when to speed up and when to slow down. And when to...
Well, and a lot of that, they say that a director's 80% of a director's job is completed if he casts right. And if you cast right with people who have this intuition and whatever, then your job, you can sit back a little bit. Or the fourth one is ensemble, how treating groups, the styles, how you use the interaction with more than, you know, two people or one person.
Ensemble is very important because there have been some plays in the last couple of years that I've seen where directors have scenes going on maybe on the left here, and then on the right there are other actors in an ensemble that are throwing food at each other and generally taking away from the scene. So you can't really do that and keep the audience's attention. Yes. You're going to lose it right away.
Who can forget in Avenue Q when the puppets were downright in darkness, to be sure, doing sexual acts that even the most skilled porn star would be hit. Have hard time to doing, and so a lot of people were looking at that or walking out, I'm told. You know, the audience talking back to the production. But yeah, so how true. Well, you know what, and James is about ready to kill me, but we're going to do this last segment, boys, if you don't mind, so we can end tonight's time together. And but you have to leave. Who has to leave at 8?
I need to leave at 8.
We'll be finished at 7:30. Yeah. It was 7:30. But I want to talk about acting, the approach to acting. Again, this, you know, the directors, the actors. Where does this leave the critic? Well, the critic needs to be able to look at a play and see someone's superb acting and I'd be on the same. Most people could leave the theater and say, oh my God, wasn't that a beautiful job of acting? I just was transfixed. Well, fine, but you're not writing a review. But if you're a critic, you are looking at that, and you're seeing the choices. You're seeing that this a superb job, say it's had a gobbler, superb job, head is doing a superb job. And with the choice after choice after choice, that the critic, in order to have some inches into this column, is going to need to probably find some. We always find things to criticize, and say, I wouldn't, you know, wouldn't have done that or whatever. But anyway, once again, this is why I think what we're doing is important on this topic of theater criticism. But now, again, I'm coming back to external and internal. External acting, this is the kind that used to be, you know, the 19th century, very stylized, non-realistic, you know, declamatory and all that. What else can you say about external?
Well, I don't know. I think external isn't just from the past, it's now, because you work on your internal things, but at the same time you're making decisions about how you want to look and what you want to, you know, and all of that affects your performance. Many times I need to see myself in a mirror as I would look as this character. And sometimes when you see that, it leads you right into your internal work. But so I think they work very well together.
John?
I think the two go hand in hand. I think most...
It's integrated.
Yeah, uh-huh. I think you can't exclusively do one and exclusively do the
other. It'd be very boring, wouldn't it?
Well, it probably would. But I think, you know, you have to go with what works for you. And some actors are very technically adept, and they can make you think they're feeling something. And other actors are working internally, and they actually are feeling something.
Yeah. When I have written reviews of shows, I typically if I've forgotten that there was any acting going on, then I consider it a good performance. Whereas if I had forgotten this was a person who, and I hate to seem like I'm kissing up to James Dean, like he owes me money, but in visiting Mr. Green, you know, it was difficult to imagine after the show him hopping off stage and suddenly, you know, having being full of energy, because, you know, you have a performance where somebody encompasses every aspect of this character to the point where they're just, you don't see a person acting. You don't see that.
It's yes, absolutely. Superb performance, James. Now, and also, critics will talk about voices, won't they? Actors' voices. Is it musical? Is it pleasant? What about volume to be heard and understood? How important is that?
Well, you have to be heard. I don't know that you always have to be understood. It depends. I think that, you know, Marlon Brando's gotten a bad rap in the past about mumbling, but he was electric on stage, apparently, and anyone who saw him in Streetcar was just, you know, blown away by him, and I'm sure you didn't understand every word he said. So understanding every word is not everything in the play.
And I also, you have to be heard. You know, you have to be heard. And when you're on stage, you're playing to the back of the house. Mm-hmm. And to my way of thinking, voice training is not considered an intrinsic part of acting study much anymore. It used to be back in the day, but now lessons don't involve it. And that's a little sad, because I work with a lot of young people whose voices need a little bit of work.
Yeah. Uh-huh. In every way. Yeah. So what about the physicality of actors? I sent a note to an actor that I saw not long ago on stage, and I said, I enjoyed your performance very much, but I suggest you take some dancing, study some dancing. And I think I kind of offended him. I'm asking you, for heaven's sake, I shouldn't be talking. But I mean, my point is that dancing can help with the fluidity, and not necessarily doing dance steps, but just being lithe and having it at your command to, if the character calls for this or that.
I think probably some dance is worthwhile. I did not want to take dance lessons when I was in college because I watched dancers on stage and I always thought they looked like dancers on stage. They never moved like real people to me, and I didn't want that to affect my movement on stage.
Uh-huh. Yeah. All right. Well, listen, one more thing. Actors must confront three kinds of texts: the script itself, context, and subtext. Script itself, we all know what that is. What is context, James, John, James?
John, James.
I think in terms of who you are, where you are, and what you're doing with regard to context.
Right. And what about subtext?
It's what you really mean. You're not always saying what you really mean.
In fact, 90% of the
time. Yeah, that's right.
Off stage and on.
Right.
Does this make me look fat? There's text and subtext.
Well, thank you so much for putting up with me this evening, Uchu. It's just wonderful, and Mary is nodding yes in approval.
Of course, I'm sorry we never got to the perfect theatrical experience, but that's okay. That'll happen someday.
Why'd you have to mention that? I'll look at him. He's thinking, how can we...
We got 30 seconds. Okay, go.
Oh, all right. I might. All right, another time.
Next time.
Thank you both. This is Lynn Pryor asking James to dim the lights and go to black. Well, I urge you all to find a play to see this week. So until next Thursday, thank you for your company. But now we always end with a pod script, a PS, a pod script, asking this question. What is the universal question? Do either of you know what the universal question is?
Are you stumped?
No idea.
Because I've thought about it, and you know what I came up with? I don't really know.
And you don't really know? Well, okay, I'm not surprised you don't.
Are you
going to
tell us?
I know the answer, and it's going to save the world, but I'm not going to share it until a later time. But you all will know when I'm going to share it. And good night.
You're not going to give it to us tonight?
Not tonight.
For I'm longing for dear old Broadway, longing for dear old town. Yes, I'm longing to stroll on Broadway, watching the world go round, to be back where the boys are.